Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Megan Cloherty, joined by Michael O'Connell. And today we have with us AJ Shavar. AJ is a video journalist for The Washington Post. After interning there during college, AJ returned to the Post after graduating from Syracuse. He was also a Carnegie Knight Fellow at Syracuse's News 21 program. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We were just talking about, before Michael joined us in the studio,
okay.
We were talking about how he got into video. And I thought it was an interesting conversation just because you talked about how you started in photo and how you kind of made that transition. Tell us about that.
So I started in photography formally when I was in high school. My father was a photojournalist, and so there were always cameras sort of around the house. But I formally started in high school and loved it. Totally changed my life plan. I originally wanted to be an engineer and decided I need to go into photojournalism. So I went to Syracuse University for their amazing photojournalism program. And as I was in that program from 2005 to 2010, the curriculum changed, and it was changing because journalism, visual journalism, especially at newspapers, was changing drastically too. And what was happening in the real world was that photojournalists at newspapers were increasingly having to learn how to put together audio slideshows, how to learn audio recorders, how to shoot video, and how to edit that and put it on the newspaper website. So in my freshman year at Syracuse, it was all photography, and same goes for the sophomore year. And right about then was when it started changing, and we were learning how to do audio slideshows, we were learning how to do video, and I'm just sort of a technically minded person. I had already learned the basics of photography because I'd been around it for so long that it was really easy for me to pick up the technical side of video, and I ended up really loving it. It took a while, but I ended up really loving video. And because of that, even though I have a photojournalism degree, my internships shifted from being photo internships to then a multimedia internship and then a full-on video internship, and then I ended up at the Washington Post doing video exclusively.
So one of the questions that I sent AJ that I'm really interested in is why he ended up at a print publication, a traditional print publication, doing video. And you said that that's sort of like the backwards way to think about it. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I think in your question you referenced why did you end up at a newspaper instead of a visually forward-thinking place like a production house or like a broadcast journalism outlet. And for me, I respect broadcast journalism, but what broadcast journalism traditionally is just isn't for me. It's great for breaking news, and it's great for talking heads and interview shows, that type of thing. But when it comes to sort of beautiful documentary stories, you don't see a lot of that in mainstream broadcast. And that's what I wanted to do. And newspapers sort of know that they can't compete with broadcast stations when it comes to the things that they're really good at. So at newspapers, you're able to work on in-depth local stories and enterprise stories, and you're able to do things that are a little more beautiful and a little more poetic on occasion than I've seen people be allowed to do or have the opportunity to do in broadcast. And, you know, production houses like Media Storm or Bombay Flying Club put out some amazing work. But for me, I enjoy a long-term project, but I just don't have the type of mind where I can work on something for a year at a time. And so I really love the daily grind of a newspaper. I like that there are constant deadlines, and that sometimes I'm doing a project that needs to be done in a couple days, and sometimes needs to be done in a couple hours, and sometimes I've got a couple weeks. I really like the variation there.
So what makes a good newspaper video project?
Or how are they assigned? I mean, are they paired up with print stories?
Are you just like a moving picture to a story, or are you a completely separate element that sort of informs it in a different way?
Well, I think we started as just being moving pictures that accompanied stories, and we're moving towards being standalone stories as media outlets move more towards just sort of all-encompassing media, right? You know, newspapers try to refer to themselves as media outlets now, not newspapers, so that
we've got a website.
Yeah, exactly. So they can sort of get everything in there. And because of that, you know, there's infinite space on the website and there's not in print. So a video can stand alone on the website. The way that stories are assigned, oftentimes we pitch stories. The video journalists will pitch stories. And oftentimes we'll get assigned stories that reporters are already working with. And Myself and I know my other colleagues at the Post also maintain good contacts with reporters whose work we really respect in the newsroom. So we try to develop these relationships where if I come up with a great story, I can go to a reporter and say, hey, this is really visual. Like, we've got to do this, but you got to write something to go with it. Or they would come to me or one of my colleagues and say, I found this great story and I need to have video with it. So it's working on making it a very collaborative environment where it's sort of a story is a story and you think about the best way to tell it. Photography historically in a newsroom was treated as like a service industry. Mm-hmm. You know, the story's done, now send the photographer out to go and do this and that. And I think that across the board in all newspapers, video has probably gone through a similar transition. But as we all know, there are some photographers, especially at the Post, that put out beautiful photojournalism and photo stories that stand alone on their own. And I think basically to get back to that original question of why a newspaper that may not be as visually thinking, you think of a newspaper as print and type. But the Post just has an amazing staff of visual journalists and visual editors that is great to be surrounded by, because you may not think it, but if you read the Post and look at the photos and go to the website, we really are a very visually forward-thinking organization.
Yeah, and it's a real progression from what was going on 5-10 years ago, where newspapers were all starting their websites and, oh, well, we've got a website, that means we can do video. Oh, we really don't have a video journalist. We'll give a video camera to a reporter. Here, we'll give her. Oh, the photographer. You know, they know photos, so they obviously know video. So now we're actually maybe getting to a point where we're actually hiring people who know video and how to tell that story and you know, enhance what we're doing, as opposed to trying to piggyback that on to somebody else's job.
For sure. I mean, the Post video department is expanding right now. If you've seen the press releases about the politics outlet that we're building. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're hiring people exclusively to work on this video. I was hired exclusively to do video at the Post. And, you know, it's interesting that you brought up how it's changed from 5-10 years ago. There was a screenshot that we were circulating on our social networks in the past couple weeks. I forget, but it was for the 10 years in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And it was a screenshot of our homepage when we started occupying Iraq. And we had it was just the webpage above the fold, but there were actually two video links visible above the fold back then. And that really comes back to what I was saying before about the Post has always been visually forward thinking. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, to have video above the fold on a website, kind of unheard of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's interesting too, because so coming from a local news standpoint, there were a lot of times where we'd get stories you have to cover. I mean, huge stories that were happening that day, maybe like policy stories or, you know, at City Hall or whatever, and you had to make them a video story. And that was the medium, you know? And I think it's sort of interesting the way you were just describing, you know, visually like forward thinking, because you can do a video story, but obviously it lends itself to video. It's not like mm-hmm. you're forced to do something that isn't going to work visually, yeah. You know,
on that note, everyone that works as a visual journalist, no matter where you work, gets that assignment or gets that as part of an assignment, that you've got to take something that is not visual at all and make it visual. And
be creative.
Yeah. And so when we covered the Democratic and Republican National Conventions this past summer, I had never been to them before. I was excited to go, obviously, huge election year. And we were tasked with coming up with ideas of stories and videos that we could do while we were there. We were sending a whole video unit. We did live interviews there. We had a whole live production going, as well as the video journalists that were there. And I wanted to do something that was not going to be, you know, I did this story, but I didn't want to do like 5 day in the life of a delegate or, here's what the floor looks like. I didn't want to do like 30 second clips mm-hmm. of short little things that weren't going to be visual, right? Right. They would be informative, but they wouldn't be visual. So mm-hmm. I started planning way ahead of time for this. And there was a video that really inspired me by this video collective called Every Nun. They do a couple videos for public radio.
Yeah. Their stuff is great.
Yeah, it's amazing. So they had a video called Symmetry that really inspired me, and the whole video is done in split screen, and I loved it. And my only critique in my head when I first saw it was that there's no story to this. It's sort of two independent things, and they're contrasting, and it touches on all of these opposites, but there isn't an overarching story. And I thought, well, what if I could take that concept of a split screen and apply that to the Democratic and Republican conventions? So what I did was, the Republican convention happened first, and I shot a ton of scenes there with my video camera that is if I were shooting stills. I just shot scenes. And then when we got to the Democratic convention, I tried to shoot the corresponding scene at the Democratic convention. And then I paired these together and set them to music, and we had this. It's not exactly a story. It's not exactly just a video, but it was sort of almost a meditation on all the similarities and differences between the two parties, between the two conventions, and really just about politics and what unites us and what divides us. And that was something that I was really proud to work on, because I felt that I'd taken something that was really not that visual and made something that at least I was excited about.
You know, and it's interesting because it goes back to sort of what you were saying before about what you're able to do in the newspaper as opposed to like a broadcast outlet. I mean, you know, if you're going to do a, you know, 3-minute piece for, or 2-3 minute piece for a news TV station, I mean, you've got to do a story.
Mm-hmm.
You've
got to, introduce, like you are crazy.
You got to introduce people, but what you're describing is almost like a mood piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like, remember that, I guess it's still on the CBS morning show on Sunday, where they just put like a camera out in the middle of a field and they just play a little music or something. And it's, you know, very indulgent, but it's also a very mood piece. It makes you feel something. And then being able to go into a news story to cover a news story, and you're actually reporting the event, but you're not telling the story. You're allowing the images and the progression of things and the edits that you've obviously chose.
Exactly. And a lot of people ask what makes a good newspaper video, and I think it's very different from what makes a good broadcast video, because newspaper stories, and especially now with the web, are always available, right? You can always go back to them. Whereas broadcast video stories, for the most part, they're on, and if you didn't catch it, it's gone. So I think what makes a good newspaper video story is one that people are moved to share. And I was thinking of that, and I try and think of that when I do my videos now. What is a way that I can tell this story or edit this, or what is just something that I can put together that is visually appealing but goes also a little deeper than that, that people are just going to be motivated to want to share with people and do that, because you can't share broadcast journalism, really. I mean,
It's like a real funny or unusual story.
Unless it's something that ends up on YouTube, right?
Yeah.
But I really think that you need to sort of get your audience motivated to want to come back to your website, because it's not like the TV, which is always there in your house and you can always flip it on and catch the news. People need to make the decision to go to your website. And granted, everyone has a computer. They have their homepage. They have their news website that they always go to. But they may not always click on the videos tab. But if they've seen something that was really different that they really like, maybe they'll give that tab another consideration the next time they come.
See, when Megan and I were in the interactive journalism program at American University, and we took a video class, and one of the things they were talking about is, you know, that the longer the video is, the more people sort of drop out of it. That there's this sort of ideal sort of time about how long a video should be, just because people aren't going to stick around to watch the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how do those considerations come into the way you assemble things?
Sometimes they are a real consideration. And sometimes I think about that, because everyone has had that experience when you get into video. I mean, to bring it back to broadcast, once again, you've got your A or B or C slot to fill, and it's got to be a certain length, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you would never tell a writer, well, people are only going to read the first two paragraphs of your story, so only write those, right?
Mm-hmm.
If that story is amazing and the first two paragraphs really hook them, you can keep them going for, you know, 40 inches in the newspaper. You can get them reading a couple thousand word story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same with video. And we had a discussion in the video department recently that I was really proud of. And we talked about what qualifies a successful video for us. And we identified a couple things that that we would say make a video successful. And one is the obvious one that everyone always hears about in digital journalism, which is page views. If a video gets a lot of page views, it's successful right. because it generated ad revenue. But we talked about beyond that, a video that maybe it only gets 100 views, but it's about an issue that's really important, right? Say it's something to do with the ongoing Mayor Gray corruption scandal. Mm-hmm. And it's a video and that probably would get a lot of views. So maybe that's not the best example, but say it didn't get many views, but it was a really important piece of journalism that we did. Well, we count that as a win. And then say there's a 10-minute long video that we do and it gets a moderate amount of views, doesn't generate a ton of ad content that maybe a 30-second, you know, mm-hmm. video of the meteor over Russia would get a ton yeah. of views. But that video is a success because it's managed to keep a percentage of those viewers on our website for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And if they're there for 10 minutes, they're more likely to go and explore other parts of the website. So we try to approach each story individually, I've found. And we've done videos that are 10, 15 minutes long. And I would highlight the work of the New Jersey Star-Ledger, too. They've put out feature-length documentaries, mm-hmm. which is amazing. And they've found an audience for that, just as we've found an audience for our longer-form journalism, too. So that three-minute rule, which I often hear is, video's got to be 3 minutes because it 3 minutes, that's when viewers start dropping out. Well, that's not always true. You can go and look at the metrics on your video, and you can see one-minute videos that people only watch 10 seconds of, and you can see a 10-minute video that people watch 8 minutes of.
Well, and coincidentally, this podcast that we do is a bit of a revelation for me that we're talking long-form conversation, putting out content out there that for people to sort of digest it in a different way. And I think that maybe that's something that's happening in on the internet right now is that we're beginning to see people using, the content in different ways or consuming it in different ways, wanting to get different things out of it. They don't want just necessarily the 10-second cat video. They mm-hmm. want, they want something that they can stick their teeth in. They're more comfortable with sitting and watching a long video.
Well, we just put together a great interactive multimedia experience, and it was called Cycling's Road Forward, and we put it out, the social tag for it was hashtag Cycle Forward, mm-hmm. and that was this really beautifully well-designed piece. Our interactive projects team did an amazing job on it, and what it did was it synthesized the text of this amazing story. Coming back to that, it was a really long story, mm-hmm. And it had photos, it had interactive graphics, and it had several videos that I worked on partly and that the reporter also shot video for, that were woven literally in the text. There were some videos that we purposely decided to design into it in a way that broke the text and caught the reader's attention as, hey, you should stop reading for a second and watch this and return to the story when you're done. Whether or not people did that is not something we can really track.
Right, that's dangerous, but it's also a different model.
Yeah, it's something where we had all of these videos on one page and they were scattered throughout the story and you could choose to watch them or not watch them or read it and then watch all of them or watch all of them and then read it. And you got something from both of them. Mm-hmm. And that is, what we call now user engagement. And just by the way that package was designed, it engaged people a lot longer than our normal article template would. And I'm confident that it got a lot more people to watch those videos than our normal article mm-hmm. template might too. And obviously you can't do that for every single story. Not every single story merits something of that scale.
Right.
But it is a nice way that we can think about this in visual journalism now is in terms of engagement.
Yeah. Speaking on engagement is something that people don't always think about when they come to a news site is that it's not linear. You're not going to have the same experience that another person who's going to come to that website. You're going to choose which video you're going to watch. You're going to choose the audio or whatever. You're going to, open up graphics in different ways. And so that presents challenges, that each element has to kind of work together, but to tell and reinforce the same story.
I have kind of a controversial question to ask.
Okay. Dun,
dun, dun. Do you think that your audience or even the Post considers what you're doing supplemental?
No, not at all. I definitely don't think that anyone at the Post thinks that what we're doing is supplemental. In terms of our audience, that's something that I really can't know. But I will say that when I do a video story, I've never had anyone reach out to me and comment with anything other than something positive. You know, obviously,
that's great.
Obviously, and I'm not. I'm not. I'm not referencing comment sections when I say that, because comment sections are always always negative.
Right.
But and maybe it's just in the fact that those were the people that were moved enough to shoot an email or whatever. But I think especially. And maybe it's a grassroots thing. As more and more people get interested in it, maybe they don't see it as supplemental. I mean, certainly, you talked about everyone can experience the site differently. If you come to our site and maybe you only watch the Wire videos that we put on it, then you may very well think that video is supplemental to the site. But maybe you come to our site and you really enjoy the Wonk Talk videos that we're putting out, or you really like The Fold, which is our nightly news broadcast, or maybe the only thing that you consume in the morning is 59 seconds, which is a summary of the headlines in less than a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe then the news isn't the video is not supplemental to you. It's a way of breaking in to the rest of the website.
Well, it's interesting too, because obviously I'm sure at the Post, but I assume at the Post, much like most websites and traditional media, your audience is changing. Your audience isn't anymore the people who are picking up the paper on their driveway in the morning. It's more likely the audience that's signing in every day and exploring the website the way they want to. So it's not necessarily that video is supplemental to print, because print isn't their number one thing anymore. I mean, is that a way to look at it?
It's not the form.
Yeah, it's not their only medium.
Well, I can't really comment on what's the number one thing of a newspaper anymore, if it's print or digital.
Isn't
I mean,
funny,
I don't.
Though?
Yeah, but
what's the number?
You know,
one thing
I think say? That they're equally important, especially here in DC, when a lot of the people that read the Post in print tend to be people that have had subscriptions for years and years and years and years, and a lot of our online audience. And I can't get into specifics because I don't know them, but I know that the majority of our online audience is broader than our local audience. So even though the Post is technically a local paper, our online audience is more national. And so because of that, you know, the print side has a duty to they're really not, it's really not any sort of division, but there's the print product, the print part of the Post. There's a duty to deliver that to the readers that have consumed the Post that way for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the people that maybe only read that and don't read the website would see the teases and links and ads for things that we have on our website and pull it up on their computer.
Yeah, we had Tom Jackman in here a few weeks ago talking about how sort of the community aspect, the nature of the Post being a nationally and internationally recognized news source, but then also having to balance that with the fact that you are covering a city, you are covering an area, and the challenges that sort of creates.
I think it's a good time to talk about social, because I mean, obviously, the way that you kind of can tell, it's almost a metric. You can tell how much people like the video is how often they share it. But when you came in, you shot a Vine video.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that's a new thing, relatively new. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you use it and, you know, what the response has been on Vine?
Well, I'm much more of an Instagram user than Vine, partly because of my photo background. Right. But we are using Vine at the Post, and we're using a couple other video apps too. Vine, we actually have a project. People always love this gallery that we put together called 40 Eats. Mm-hmm. And last year it really took off, and it was sort of the 40 dishes that you have to eat as a Washingtonian.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and so this year they did the same thing, and the gallery is already out. But now for the next, I think this week was the first week, so there's going to be 7 more. And each day of the week, a different reporter, I think it's one reporter takes the week. But they'll be vining each meal that's on the 40 Eats and then sharing it on social, and then we'll be putting that together.
That's a good idea,
because
it doesn't have to be a long thing.
Exactly.
Explain what Vine is, just in case some people don't know.
Okay, so Vine is, I believe it was made by Twitter, or Twitter snapped it up, but it is an application that lets you record 6-second video clips, and you have to edit them as you're shooting. So you hold your finger down and record the first 2 seconds, point the camera at something else, record the next two or next three or whatever, or you record one long clip, and then it loops like a GIF. Not a GIF, as some people might say. It is pronounced GIF. It's a G.
This is very important.
Yes. So anyway, you know, Vine is something that I'm just sort of dipping my toe into right now, personally. Mm-hmm. Other people at the Post have really jumped on it and are great at it. I'm trying to figure out exactly how I want to use it and what I like and don't like about it so I can sort of tailor it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to social as a whole, Instagram for me is huge. One, because I tend to think in stills when I'm putting a video together. So I think of if I was putting a photo story together, what shots do I need for that? And I shoot them in video and combine that into a moving project. But with Instagram, that's almost sort of like my storyboard sometimes. And there's a ton of stuff that I shoot on my phone that just doesn't get posted. Mm. And I just snap a bunch of stuff when I see something. And oftentimes what I'll do with Instagram is post something from a story that I'm currently working on and tweet it out and say, here's what I'm currently shooting. This story is going to be on our website in the next week or so. So
it's like
tune
a tease
in for it. Exactly.
Huh.
And you know, the more that you get into, the more that you put into these networks, the more you get out of them. And it was interesting. I actually spoke to a class a couple weeks ago up at Syracuse about social media and visual journalism. And they said, well, how do you get more followers and how do you do this and that? And the best advice that I can give on that note is just to sort of be yourself, and the people that like that and like what you're giving and know that you're being genuine are going to really like that, and they'll respond to it. So that's why I try and give sort of a off-the-cuff view of what I'm currently doing. Sometimes it's a photo of the back of my camera. Sometimes, you know, it's a photo of just some amazing place that I've been able to go because I work at the Post. And sometimes it's a documentary still image of what's actually happening in front of me. And I find that the instantness of it really is a nice way to connect with an audience that wants to look at things, that is visually minded, right? Because they're on Instagram.
Right.
So they can see that and know that there's more to it. And they also know that they can come back and see that more when it's finished.
Tell us about, so the reason that I contacted AJ in the first place is because he did a video of this guy named Cedric Givens. Is that correct?
Yes.
His name's right?
Yep.
And he jogs backwards through Washington every single day. And I feel like most people in DC have seen him, and I thought of it as a story, but it's just kind of one of those things, like it's not necessarily, it doesn't really affect anybody, but it's something that everybody's probably seen. Tell us a little bit about like the background, how you found him, how you shot it.
Sure. So this was, we were talking about how the different genesises of stories, and this was one that a magazine reporter found, Joe Heim, and he was reporting on it and contacted the video department and said, hey, like, this is clearly a visual story. We need to get someone on this.
And he's a character, too.
He is a real character. And so he set me up. Joe set me up with Cedric's contact information. I contacted Cedric, who he is very eccentric. And there was actually a discussion on the comment thread of the video of, does he only do this for the attention? I'm of the opinion that he does not only do it for the attention. He really loves doing it. But he also, I think, really likes attention. So he was really game for it. So I went there and interviewed him, and the interview was one of the most just riotously funny things I've ever recorded. I mean, the stuff that was left on the cutting room floor, so to speak, was just out there. He's a really cool, really friendly guy. And so I followed him on his route, and he's been doing this, I'm going to get the year wrong, but I want to say it's like 84. He's been doing this every other day since 84, jogging backwards from his house on H Street to the White House and back. And when he gets to the intersections, he stands on one foot and he spins and jumps around and hoots and hollers. And I mean, Chinatown is where people really know him, because that's where he gets in the middle of the intersection right by the pagoda, the arch there. And the traffic goes around him, and everyone in Chinatown kind of knows him, but they don't know who he is or why he's doing it. So it was really interesting, as I was shooting this story, people would say, oh, yeah, that guy, he's back. Like, do you know him? Like, what's his story? And I would say, well, I'm doing a story for the Post, so you can check the magazine when it comes out.
From a shooting standpoint, did you decide to do it like as a, you know, from the beginning of his route to the end?
Or? Pretty much. I mean, I followed him from his house to the White House, and I was on a bike, and he was jogging backwards. And he doesn't jog very fast backwards. I mean, he is 60, and he's in phenomenal shape. But I mean, who could jog backwards quickly at any age?
So, it's pretty hard to do.
Yeah. So I was on my bike primarily so that I could get a couple blocks ahead of him easily and wait for him without wearing myself out the whole time. And so I followed him from his house all the way to the White House, and that was when I decided to break it off. You're just going to see the same stuff if we went all the way back to his house. And he was just a real, real character. He was really friendly for the camera. He had never, I don't think he'd ever been interviewed before I met him, but I'm pretty sure CBS did a story after they saw our story. Mm-hmm. And they interviewed him as he was jogging. I interviewed him in his backyard for mm-hmm. about a half hour, 40 minutes or so, mm-hmm. and then followed him running for maybe, going to lose track of time, but I want to say it was probably 90 minutes to get from his house to the White House. Maybe a little shorter.
And I think it's a good time to talk about transitions, too, because, you know, when you're taking just a still photograph, you don't have to think about necessarily how that photo is going to move to the next photo, you know, unless mm-hmm. you're doing a sound slides or something. But when you were shooting that, obviously the location's going to change. I mean, tell us about he had to go in and out of frame. I mean, it had to be a little bit challenging as far as how you were going to put it together, because as you're shooting it, you should think about how you're going to edit.
Yeah, that's something that I've done a couple multimedia workshops and helped people sort of learn how to get their footing with video. And it's generally people that I've taught at these have been photographers or photo students transitioning into video for the first time. And I always tell them, so when you're working on a photo story, there's this collection of shots that you know you need for visual variety. It's super wide shot, a wide, tight, medium, super tight, mm-hmm. detail shot, a cutaway shot, a scene setting shot, all of these things. So what I often tell people is, so all of those different shots and angles, you need to do that for every sequence that's going to be in your video. So if you see Cedric running across the bridge behind Union Station, I had about 15, 20 clips of him on the bridge to get enough visual variety. In some clips, I'm doing a panning shot and following him. In some, he's just running from one side of the frame across to the other, and the camera's stable. In some, I'm only shooting his feet. In some, I'm only shooting his face. In some, I'm super wide. In some, I'm really tight.
Well,
so
and
all
meanwhile,
of that,
the action is happening.
And exactly. I mean, it's not like I can say, okay, I need you to run the bridge again for this other angle. So one of my personal rules when I go out and shoot is B-roll clips, unless they need to be, are never longer than 10 seconds. So I had this collection of 10-second clips of him, you know, going over the bridge, and then a collection of 10-second clips spinning in the intersection. And just sort of by the nature of having all of these clips, you've got to force yourself to get different angles and force yourself to get different styles. And that visual variety lets you sort of make a seamless cut from one to the other mm-hmm. and follow the action through.
Well, let's be crass and talk just basic numbers. How long was the finished video?
I think it was, I'm not going to be exact here. I think it was 3.5 minutes.
And how much total video would you say you shot?
Total video. So let's see, a 30-minute interview.
Uh-huh.
And estimate the number of clips. So I probably shot a 30-minute interview and at the most 10 or 15 minutes of B-roll.
Okay, so 45, 50 minutes
of raw tape
down.
Well, raw memory card. Yeah.
And that probably is typical of a yeah. percentage of what you're shooting.
So, generally, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the reason I bring this up is just, you know, for people who may be listening to this who may not have a lot of experience or just learning to do videos, to understand that you don't just, you know, oh, I've got a 3-minute video, oh, I'll go shoot 4.5 minutes of a video, that you really need to put the time in and think about the shots.
It's interesting, actually, when I'm working with students, I normally get the opposite of that,
which is overshooting,
which I think is a bigger problem than undershooting. If you undershoot, you can go back and get more things and still keep it tight. Mm-hmm. But if you overshoot, I mean, you've just got way too much footage to weave, and especially if you're not making a new clip for every angle when mm-hmm. you shoot. if we're really getting into the weeds here.
Sure.
You know, if you don't create a new video file or a new clip each time you change your angle or change your shot, that makes sorting through your shots and editing that much harder, because now you've got a 20-minute video clip that's got 100 different shots on it, mm-hmm. and you need to figure out where in that 20 minutes is the shot that you're actually looking mm-hmm. for, instead of scrolling through a list of thumbnails and being able to pick them
yeah,
out immediately.
And once you get into the editing processes, we've, you know, at AU and in our jobs where we do some video, you know, the editing process is the crazy part of shooting. That's when you need to start, you know, that takes a lot of time, and that's where it's helpful to have sort of preparation in when you're out in the field and shooting things, of, you know, organizing yourself, going out there knowing what you get. When do you think about, do you always get time to sort of ahead of time to think about a project, or do you get assignments that morning and say, oh, you need to be here and do this?
More often than not, I know about a story that I'm covering before mm-hmm. I have to go out and shoot it.
Sure.
And I try to do, I'm really not the best person at this, but I try to plan as much as possible before mm-hmm. I go out, even if it's just 10 minutes of me sitting and making a mental list and not writing anything down, because the more pre-planning that you do, the less work that you have to do when you get to editing, which is the hard part. The, mm-hmm. you know, the fun part is when you're in the field shooting, and then the hard part is the edit, and then the fun part again is when you're done with the edit and yeah. you can look at it and be happy with it, or not be happy with it, but at least be done with it. So sometimes before I shoot, I'll create a shot list of things that I need. Sometimes I will just have a mental note of different techniques that I want to use. And sometimes if on the rare occasion that I've been assigned something and won't be able to shoot it for a week, be it because of my scheduling or because whatever it is isn't happening for a week, I might go into it with a fully developed plan, and then it's sort of like a fill in the blank of get this, look for someone who can give me a quote about this, a quote about this, and then put it all together.
Although it's hard to over, I mean, you can't over plan either.
No.
Because
no.
when you get there, things change.
That's true.
Let me ask you about this project that you mentioned that the Post is doing. Can you talk at all about
the politics?
The politics, what they're doing?
I'm not the best person to talk about it because I don't know all of the ins and outs of it. That's really something more our director of video
Andy.
Is more knowledgeable. Yeah, Andy. The idea is to create some great political content that is produced in-house at the Post. And, you know, people have been talking about it because the job postings have been up and the press
right.
release went out and everything. And, you know, I think that the real idea for this is to leverage the Post's great access and acumen when it comes to political analysis and reporting
mm-hmm.
and really just create a place where video for that can live. Be it through a discussion show or a news magazine type show. They've got a couple different things planned. And it's just leveraging all of the great talent that already exists in the Post writers and making something unique in video to put that together. And that'll be on the Post website. I believe it will also be in the Post apps that we have, not just the brand new iPad app, which if you have an iPad, you should go and download it right now because it's an amazing app.
Mm-hmm.
I say that not just because I work there. This is what I wish other newspaper apps looked like. Or our awesome mobile app that we have, the Post TV app
mm-hmm.
and the Fold app that are built on. I don't think they're built on Google, but they run on the Google TV and app and not Apple TV yet, the Boxy box and the Roku
okay.
set-top
gotcha.
Boxes.
Okay.
So though that's a way for you to access future Post video content if you have one of those. So
AG, tell us about, as a wrap-up question, tell us about how you're feeling about journalism. Obviously, you're coming from a let's see, how do I say this?
Video.
Inspired place.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people
forward-looking.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people are sort of in a downturn, and you're in a position where, you know, your multimedia skills are being valued. But, I mean, tell us about how you're feeling moving forward with journalism.
Well, personally, I feel great. And I think that a lot of people talk about the downfall of journalism
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the internet is just killing journalism, or the 24-hour deadlines are killing journalism. It's like all through journalism school, all I heard about was what was killing journalism. But anytime, like I worked for three and a half years at my campus newspaper and loved it. and everyone that worked there loved journalism. And everyone that I've been with in internships and at the Post really loves what they're doing. And I think that, you know, newspapers especially are having a really hard time with the economy and with, you know, just money in general. Budgets are tight at newspapers all over the country. But if you look at the work that's being produced at any newspaper right now, I guarantee you it's better than the work that that newspaper was producing 10 years ago.
Yes.
Because the tools that we have at our disposal now and the way that just storytelling has evolved in pretty much every aspect because of this force of the internet, of pushing everyone to constantly be evolving and changing, you know, say what you will about sites like BuzzFeed and Huffington Post and aggregators, but because of that, that's really forced competition, right? It's that open market sort of thing where, well, they can aggregate this, this, and this, so we've mm-hmm. got to put out something really original that makes people want to come to our site.
Right.
We've got to put something together like Cycle Forward that can't be aggregated, mm-hmm. but that other people are going to write about and send people to our website. And so I think when it comes to the state of journalism in terms of quality, it's amazing right now. I really believe that it's amazing right mm-hmm. now. And I think that it's hard for us as journalists to see that when you know how tough it is on the inside. And mm-hmm. you see, I don't work at a small paper right now, but I know I have interned at small papers. I know a lot of people at small papers, and they are afraid. You know, they are worried about what's going to happen to their job and this and that. And those are all legitimate fears, and it's really hard to divorce yourself from that when you're thinking about the state of journalism. On the business side, it's in a really rough spot right now, but quality of journalism that's being put out almost everywhere is miles above what it's been.
Yeah, I think people, despite the situation, I think journalists are optimists. I think a journalist has to be an optimist if they feel they can cover something and that they're going to write about something that people are going to care. You got to have to be an optimist in that way. But I think there's a reason to be optimistic. I think I agree with you 100%. I think the quality of journalism that we're experiencing right now is astounding. And part of it is the fact that we have all these tools that make our jobs a lot easier. But then also that we have people who are embracing these tools and using them to tell really good stories.
Ending on a high note.
Yes.
Well, AJ, thank you for joining us. Can you tell us where we can find your work online?
Sure. You can go to WashingtonPost.com/video. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram everywhere. It's just AJ Shavar.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.